In the news.
Good morning, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for Introduction to American and Texas Government.
I think this is our last session for this second semester of the summer, so congratulations. You guys all made it to the finish line. That's looking pretty good. Professor McDaniel kind of drove the train, and I noticed you've got non-voters in the 2016 election. To what are you referring here?
So there's a piece in the Washington Post which is highlighting the role of non-voters, and the piece seems to suggest that people who did not turn out to vote had just as much of an effect on the election as those who did not. And specifically, they argue the demographics of those who did not turn out to vote looked like Democrats. And so if they did turn out to vote, we may have had a completely different election. Specifically arguing that the number of people or the percentage of Americans that were eligible to vote who chose not to vote was higher than the percentage of Americans who chose to vote for either Hillary Clinton or President Trump. And so their argument is that non-voters swayed this in a major way. And there has been this argument specifically in certain states such as Michigan because of lower levels of turnout, specifically amongst African Americans, after you saw high levels of turnout in 2008 and 2012 with Obama on the ticket. The idea was trying to continue that momentum. Now, but one thing that is important to note is while some people may question this issue of non-voters, that if they had turned out to vote, this would have mattered. One group of non-voters that we're not talking about are those who voted for Trump. One of the things that President Trump was able to do, much like President Obama was able to do, was get people who traditionally did not vote to turn out to the polls. And one of the things that research has shown is that Americans who express kind of high levels of nationalism, or specifically really buy into the America First motto, these individuals were referred kind of sometimes as uncritical patriots, or kind of the idea of America, love it or leave it, they're actually less likely to participate. And what's important to note is that it looks like in this election, President Trump was actually able to get these individuals out to vote. And so it's important to note that we're talking about story about non-voters. It's some part of the story is certain people didn't turn out to vote, but certain people who traditionally don't vote did vote. And so it's a very tricky story. But I know Professor Shaw has a much more nuanced discussion about really the influence of non-voters in elections.
Well, it's kind of funny because, Professor McDaniel saw this article. And actually, a friend of mine, a colleague, Mark Hetherington in North Carolina, sent me the same piece from Washington Post. And if we could, I'd like to put we have a graphic prepared from the article. The essence of the Washington Post article is that as you all know from the lecture on turnout, about 60% of people, eligible voters, voted in the 2016 election. It was down a little bit from 2008, up a little bit from 2012. So, right in that 60% ballpark. And the question is, or the data that the Washington Post brought to bear, speak to the issue of whether non-voters have distinct preferences from voters. And so, if non-voters had participated, would the election have shifted? Right, and this is an interesting question, right? We're always interested in questions of democratic representativeness and full participation. And this is something that political science has considered quite a bit. What would happen if everybody showed up and voted? Would our elections be different? Is there a systematic skew to the composition of the electorate such that the act of voting, the participatory act itself, when certain people decide not to do that, actually has an impact on outcomes. Now, as Professor McDaniel said, I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about this lately, and I think that what the Washington Post does here is both instructive and useful and a little misleading. Right? And it's instructive and useful in the sense that they point out, as many scholars have pointed out before, that non-voters don't look like voters demographically. That is to say, the non-voting segment of the population is less educated. It's a little more non-white, that is Asian and Hispanic, and to a lesser extent, African Americans, and this last point has changed a little bit lately, are less likely to vote than white. So the non-voting population is less white. It tends to be younger. And so you add all that up and you go, well, wait a sec. Non-voters seem to look a lot like Democrats. You know, would it be the case that, you know, if non-voters showed up and voted, Democrats would get more votes? And this, I think, is kind of the working assumption behind a lot of political science literature, and it's really the working assumption behind the Washington Post article, right? The Post article says, you know, non-voters gave Trump the election. You know, if they had showed up and voted, Clinton would have won enough votes in some of these states to have won an electoral college majority, because, of course, she, in fact, did win the most popular votes, right? Okay. My sense is, and this is all I want to say about this, but I want to leave you with the somewhat counterintuitive, provocative notion. I think that the defining characteristic of non-voters is not that they are, you know, Democrats or Republicans. It's that they're not interested, they're not involved, they're not engaged with politics at the same level as voters. I mean, I shouldn't say they're not interested. They're simply not engaged and interested at the level of voters. So what happens, you know, if they showed up, what would they do? And the Post says, well, if they showed up, they would have realized their kind of latent Democratic proclivities, right? They would have showed up and voted like people who look like them ended up voting. I actually don't think that's correct. I think that the distinguishing characteristic, as I said, is that they're not really engaged or rooted in the political system. They're not partisan the way that voters are. So if they did show up, they would be more susceptible to short-term forces than voters are. Sometimes those forces favor the Republicans, sometimes they favor the Democrats. So if you're out there thinking, well, you know, if there's a high turnout election, Democrats are axiomatically going to do better, I think you're going to be disappointed. The short answer is, it depends. You know, the answer to the question, what would happen if everybody showed up and voted? You know, in 1984, if non-voters would have voted, Reagan would have won by even more. In 1996, if non-voters would have voted, Clinton would have won by even more, because the short-term forces in those elections favored, you know, in 84 they favored Reagan and the Republicans, in 96 they favored Clinton and the Democrats. So you get low turnout elections like 2010 where the Republicans do really well. But you also had a low turnout election in 2006 and the Democrats swept the House and the Senate. So in 2018, if you have a low turnout election, can we say the Republicans are going to do relatively well? I don't think so. I think the short-term force, as it looks right now, is going to be slightly favorable to the Democrats. So it's not clear to me at all that a lower turnout election is going to hurt the Democrats in 2018. In fact, it may help, because the question turnout is really kind of more of a factor on the Republican side than the Democratic side. Okay, so at any rate, that's the end of my little sermonette on this. The Post article is worth reading. It is absolutely the case that non-voters look demographically like they'd be more favorable to Democratic candidates and Democratic issue positions. That's absolutely true. What I'm suggesting to you is that move away from the partisanship and consider the possibility that their defining characteristic is actually their level of engagement or lack thereof, not so much their latent partisanship. Okay, so now there's a big caveat here. Professor McDaniel and I were talking about this before class, and the caveat is African-American non-voters, right? I think the define, you know, if African-American non-voters show up on election day, they almost certainly would vote Democratic, right? They don't blow, you know, just because, you know, people liked Reagan in 1984, it doesn't mean the black voters were going to vote for Reagan had they, you know, had certain black non-voters showed up at the polls. Right? That's a complication. But I would also say that the flip side of that is interesting as well, is that, you know, is the racial divide politically, that is the attachment of African Americans to the Democratic Party becomes more, you know, solid, which seems impossible, but it's actually increased in the last 10 or 15 years, whites have become more committed to the Republican Party. So it's still not entirely clear to me that this Washington Post story actually holds. The other fine point is federalism, the electoral college, the distinction, the breakdown of the presidential election, because it's not a national election, it's a collection of elections across states. I think the story of turnout in 2016 varies depending upon the state. Professor McDaniel correctly pointed out, Michigan was the state where turnout dropped from 2012 to 2016. And it looks like it disproportionately dropped in African-American areas, you know, like Wayne County, like in Detroit. Although it's hard to tell sometimes because Detroit is losing registered voters at a rate that it's hard to tell whether black turnout dropped or it's a population drop. You know, we look at the raw number of registered voters who showed up and voted, and it did drop, but Wayne also lost a lot of population. Michigan and Wisconsin, there were population drops. So this Washington Post article, I think, is more credible, more compelling in those cases. In Pennsylvania, the other key state in 2016, turnout went up. Hillary actually did better in Philadelphia and in areas where there's heavy concentrations of African Americans than Obama did in 2012, bizarre as that may seem sometimes, right? So even within the context of this Washington Post story, you have to bear in mind there's state by state, that's how elections are decided in the United States, presidential elections, actually all elections. So be attentive to that as you guys are kind of gearing up and thinking about, you know, what to make of the 2018 elections. Turnout matters, but maybe not reflexively as people sometimes think. Boy, high turnout helps Democrats. Sometimes, you know, if short-term forces favor Democrats, then high turnout will help Democrats. If not, they probably won't. So anyway, that's my sermonette.
I think what's really important here, as you pointed out, is this is local. And so a lot of these things that we're talking about are what we're talking about, turnout for the off-year elections, or if we're talking about turnout for the presidential election, a lot of this is at the local level, the state or local level. And so to really tell a story about national turnout is problematic given the role of the local and state and how things are split up. And so this is, as Professor Shaw's pointed out, these types of articles, they're interesting, they're thought-provoking, but they're flawed in the sense that they try to tell a story as if the nation is voting as one big block, when really, no, it's a bunch of smaller blocks that are doing this.
Yeah. The other thing, remember, the Washington Post article's reference to the 2016 presidential election where turnout is 60%. There will be about a 15 to 20-point drop in turnout to the midterm election. So without the big race at the top, the presidential, people are less interested, less engaged. There'll be less party efforts to mobilize voters. And so, you know, one question is, you know, what happens when you lose, you know, 20% of the eligible electorate that voted in 2016 won't be around. One in five people who voted last time around or who were eligible to vote last time won't show up and vote this time. And, you know, is that going to help the Republicans or is it going to help the Democrats because, you know, Trump's not at the top of the ticket? Or, you know, on the other hand, you know, we think of this phenomena, this decline after the surge in the presidential. There's actually a theory in political science called surge and decline, where we're talking about turnout surges in the presidential and then declines in the midterm. And typically, we think that that hurts the president's party, right? That decline in turnout, president's not at the top of the ticket, people are jazzed about voting in 2016, fall off, and that it's disproportionately hurtful to the president's party. Except what happens to this surge and decline story when the president didn't win the popular vote? You know, my sense about 2018, and this, you know, kind of argues against my, I do think there's going to be a kind of soft short-term force favoring the Democrats. I'm not going to go out on a limb on that, but I think there will be. But on the other hand, you know, we don't expect that much of a decline for Trump because there wasn't much of a surge. You know, Hillary Clinton won by 2 or 3 points. So, you know, the extent to which you win in the presidential is going to be determinative of the extent you lose in the midterm. That's just something we know, right? Big-time presidential wins are almost always accompanied by fairly significant drop-offs in the next election. Okay, a couple more topics to cover. You got a Medicare prescription drugs, which is...
Yes.
Professor McDaniel, in case you haven't figured out, is a healthcare expert, so...
Yeah, I've been to the doctor quite a bit. So this is really one thing that's popping up within health policy and really one of the major concerns specifically with Medicare. So we champion Medicare as, you know, one of the classic examples of socialism within the U.S. And there are concerns about really Medicare Part D. So Medicare Part D came about during the Bush administration as a way to control the cost of prescription drugs for the elderly. It was updated again under the Obama administration. And while people have championed it in the sense that it's lowered the cost of payments that individuals have to make, what we're not paying attention to is on the back end, the drug is becoming more expensive and the government is paying more into it. And so this piece in the Washington Post argued that one of the reasons why you see this increased cost is because of the way Medicare Part D is set up, that in some ways it actually incentivizes insurance companies to pay more for prescription drug prices because after they reach a certain limit, I think it's $5,000 out of pocket for the individual, the government comes in and starts paying for a larger portion of it, and the insurance company is off the hook for it. And so that's part of it, but also you've seen a larger and increased enrollment. And so as we're seeing the baby boomers move into retirement, we're seeing kind of this group that has that this large group that didn't have a lot of kids, and so the people who are taking are larger than the people who are contributing. And so this becomes really one of the major problems we have of regarding Social Security, Medicare, and our care for the elderly. Because again, it's something that politicians don't want to touch. It's really, in many ways, the third rail in politics. But if you really want to talk about spending, Medicare, Social Security are really the two big places, or two of the big places where you probably need to cut spending in order to get the budget where you want it.
Right. I like the graph that we've got up right now, which is from the Washington Post article. And it just talks about, doesn't talk about, it demonstrates, you know, watch my language here, get a little sloppy towards the end of the summer. It shows this increase in expected costs accruing to different aspects of healthcare in the United States. And so you can see, you know, the amount of spending that's, you see the projections, so these could change, but the projections are going to go up almost, not quite exponentially, but significantly over time. And as Professor McDaniel pointed out, a lot of that, part of it is the way we've structured the spending increases, but part of it is the target populations. As the baby boomers age, and that's a big, you know, people refer to it sometimes as the, you know, the rat in the python. You know, when a snake eats something, there's that big bulge. If you look at the age profile of the United States, the baby boomers were a huge generation. And for years, they were the ones who were paying into the system so that the elderly, you know, could be supported through these health care and Social Security arrangements. Well, the baby boomers are now not earning so much as they are retiring. And when they retire, they begin to consume those entitlement programs. And so it's Gen X and then Gen Y and the millennials who, as the dominant forces in the workforce, are going to be paying for the retirement and the medical benefits that go to that baby boomer generation. So as Professor McDaniel said, when we start thinking about commitments, deficits, things that are going to, you know, we're going to have to pay for moving forward, these are a big deal. And this obviously dovetails with the lectures modules that we've had recently on domestic policy. You know, when we talk about entitlements and the budget, we're talking about Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. And those are the huge, huge kind of, along with defense, I should point out defense, those are the huge dominant elements of the budget that nobody really wants to touch because they have constituencies that are very sensitive to those benefits, that value them enormously. And one thing we know about the elderly is the elderly do vote, speaking about turnout. So the consequences, the potential consequences for doing something that you know, that negatively impacts that constituency, the consequences could be quite significant, especially in a low turnout midterm election. If you get the, you know, the senior citizens riled up, you're asking for trouble. So at any rate, it's interesting that the article in the Post kind of talked about the cost structure and the prescription drug benefit. The, you know, we have, if anything, not if anything, it's clear, we have added to the costs associated with Medicare and Medicaid over the past 25 years, right? We have added a prescription drug benefit, not under Obama, that was under Bush, the prescription drug benefit, and then an expansion of Medicaid under Obama. So those programs are pretty popular, you know, have been historically popular, and if anything, we've tried to improve them and expand them over time. So our commitments have gotten larger over time. And that, you know, as a society, we've made some decisions that that's the appropriate thing to do. Economically, though, it's a substantial commitment, and it's a commitment that will increase over time because of the age structure of the American population.
Yeah, and it's, again, if you think about what Professor Shaw pointed out about these, there are certain parts of the budget that really nobody wants to touch. If you think about my discussion of the social construction of target populations, that the advantage of the groups that are viewed positively and also have a great deal of political power. The elderly are that. They're viewed positively and they have a great deal of political power. They turn out to vote. They have interest groups. Same thing with the military, viewed positively and are politically engaged. And so these advantage groups get a greater share of the budget because the politicians realize, look, this is a group we have to protect. Or if not have to protect, we have to take their interest into concern, or else that it will be harmful. And again, this is how a democracy works. Groups that are mobilized are able to more effectively get their issues represented.
Okay, we've got a couple a couple of interesting topics with respect to civil rights and definitions of rights. This is a theme that's been consistent throughout the semester, and you know we keep seeing it come up in the news. So you've got a couple of things. You've got Native American farmers, and then something about Texas schools and rights vis-a-vis there. So what? Elaborate on those two topics.
So the first one is that the Native American farmers settled a suit in 2010 with the federal government, in which they found the federal government had actually taken part in discriminatory practices regarding loans to Native American farmers for close to a 20-year period. And the settlement, if I remember correctly, was $680 million. However, for those who could, there are only a certain number of individuals who were actually able to make successful claims. That was about, that took about a little over half of it. But, so there's $266 million left over. And so this is now being spread out to a variety of nonprofits to try to help out in terms of paying for education, services, even training in Native American populations to try to help the Native American agricultural businesses. And so this is in many ways a way of understanding of how groups will challenge the way they've been treated by the government. But one thing that this points out is that it's a little bit messier than we think. One is that the accusation of discrimination took place from about 1981 to 1999. The decision in their favor didn't come out until 2010. There are a variety of appeals before the money was handed out. And the thing about it was the only people who got a portion of the money were those who were able to make successful claims. And so there's a lot that goes into this. And then now the leftover money will again now go to nonprofits, but it's been made very clear that the nonprofits cannot use it for policymaking. They can't use it for lobbying, things of that nature. That was one of the concerns that individuals had. But it's, again, points out to the long, drawn-out process in this, and that even though people say, oh, they won, it's not really clear who won, especially in the class action suit of who will get a piece of those funds.
Yeah, I just have a brief observation on this particular case. When we were talking about the modern civil rights movement, that is the struggle for African-American civil rights in the 1940s, 50s, and into the 60s, even into the 70s, I suppose, you know, we talked about different strategies and employing different strategies and whether those strategies were, in fact, if we'd have had you guys in and given you kind of a traditional test, you know, an essay test. One of the things I would have loved to have asked is, you know, talk about the extent to which these strategies are still relevant today. Legalism, nonviolent direct action, you know, black power. And it's interesting that the legalist strategy, which was really kind of the first temporally, that is the, you know, sequentially, it was the first one that was adopted by the modern civil rights movement, and ultimately proved kind of frustrating to people who wanted to push harder and more with more rapidity for civil rights. This still, I think, is the dominant strategy that's employed by groups that are striving for civil rights today. You know, whether it's, you know, the LGBTQ community, whether it's Native Americans, the disabled, that, you know, we still, you know, there's still an emphasis on political rights and political power. There are groups that you know, want to, you know, establish more of a kind of self-sufficiency and emphasize, you know, kind of doing things for themselves. And then there are, you know, political protests, obviously, nonviolent direct action. But man, the legalist strategy has had legs. It still has, however, the same kind of limitations we talked about earlier in the semester. It is expensive. It takes a long time. The victims have to bear the burden of the action. And so it's interesting to see, you know, Native American communities still pursuing this legalist strategy. I'm certainly not critical of it. I think it's the most obvious strategy that you would pursue. But it does come with some frustrations and limits.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And then the last thing we want to talk about is actually deals with Texas. And this is Amberlee Tatro, who passed away this week. And she is famous for suing the Irving, I think the school board in Irving, Texas, over basically certain types of treatment or health treatment. So Ms. Tatro had a variety of ailments, needed a variety of surgeries. And so because of this, she had a catheter that needed to be changed several times a day. The school refused to do it, saying that it opened up a Pandora's box that now will be taking part in a bunch of different medical procedures. And the family sued the school district, and the family won, where the Supreme Court ruled that there's a difference between medical procedures and health procedures. And so because of this, she was able to attend school, attend public school, and get provided these services. And so what's important to understand is that many of the services that we see public schools providing today are the result of these cases, where people are saying, look, in order for me to receive a proper education, receive certain things, you have to make certain amends for me. And so whether that be handicap access, whether it be certain services for students with certain disabilities, the idea is that people are making this kind of push for, if this is a public service, I should be allowed to have access to this. Now, what's important to note is that many of the people who are against charter schools are pointing to these things and say, because charter schools are different, they're treated as kind of private entities, they do not have to follow the same guidelines as the public schools. And so in many cases, the charter schools are able to keep students with certain disabilities out because because of certain expenses and things of that nature. And so one of the fears is that the growth of charter schools may actually lead to students with certain disabilities being left with nowhere to go.
Yeah, when I saw this article, Professor McDaniel brought it to my attention. The first thing I thought of was the distinctions that we've raised, not as distinctions, I guess, elements of the public policy cycle, which is, again, one of your lecture modules on the question of domestic policy. And, the extent to which problems are private versus public, and how that process gets negotiated in American politics. And it's interesting, as professors at the University of Texas, we kind of deal with some of these issues all the time. A student has a learning disability. To what extent is it the responsibility of, in this case, the University of Texas, right? The extension of the government. We don't sometimes think of ourselves that way, but we are a public university, get some public funds, not as much as people think sometimes. But when we acknowledge that it is our responsibility to provide accommodations for somebody who has, attention deficit disorder or something like that. That's interesting. 25 or 30 years ago, that was considered a you problem, right? That was your responsibility. It was the individual's responsibility to, suck it up and, figure out how to deal with it, how to compete in a university environment. But over the course of time, there was some negotiation. Well, wait a second, does that make sense? There are lots of people with this problem. It's a public unit. Isn't it the responsibility of the university to make some sort of, accommodate? And these sorts of issues occur all the time. And in the case of the Irving student, what was interesting, I think, was the extent to which it got negotiated over a single case very quickly. To what extent is the public school responsible for providing medical as opposed to health services? So that was the distinction the court raised, that if it's a medical situation, then it becomes a public issue and the public entity is obliged to provide an accommodation, right? If it had been a health concern or classified as a health issue, then the burden would have been more on the individual. And we are still, as a society, negotiating these things all the time, right? Is education, we've decided that's a public issue. All right, well, once it gets on the public docket, then the question is, well, what is the state obliged to provide? In what form? How much spending? What particular programs? What's the feedback loop? Is something get reauthorized by Congress? That whole entire cycle that we talked about kicks in. But something has to get on the agenda first. And, some of the things we think about today as being public were certainly not considered public, 25, 30, certainly 100 years ago. On the other hand, there's stuff right now that we think of as private. Who knows what we'll think of it in 25 or 30 years, right? Things that we think of as, well, that's really my problem, not UT's. Maybe in 25 or 30 years, there'll be a very different definition of what's public and what the university is obliged to provide to students, right? Is the university obliged to provide a way to get you to campus every day? Transportation, food, healthcare, these things are all, is this really part of the public responsibility the university has? Maybe. It's a dynamic thing and a fluid thing, and part of the joy of watching politics is watching these things get negotiated and figure, the government constantly, and society, I guess, too, American society, constantly trying to figure out what's public and where ought the government to, provide something versus what's the obligation of citizens and individuals on their own. Okay, so anyway, that's giving that particular issue a grander context, I suppose. But that's what we really want to do with this class, is take these singular issues and kind of loop them back to government and these bigger picture issues. So I got nothing else. You got anything?
Nope, that's it for me.
Is he Mission Impossible yet?
No, not yet.
All right, what about Incredibles?
I have been horrible when it comes to movies this summer.
Okay, okay. I saw Ant-Man and Wasp. That's good.
Yep.
That was good. I still, you know, I can't believe like Infinity War and Black Panther was this year. It feels like 10 years ago, the way, you know, the Marvel Universe is operating.
I did see those two.
Yeah. Well, in this class, we move like the Marvel Universe. We move seamlessly forward, you know, with new blockbusters basically coming out every other couple weeks.
That's so. Right. And it'll all make sense in time.
Eventually. All right. For that, I'm Thanos.
And I'm Gamora.
See you next time.
All right.